Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Coach Conversations. I'm Anna Milikian, and it's my pleasure to host this Blog Talk Radio show. Coach Conversations is sponsored by the ICF Phoenix, and usually the host is Catherine Alpen, and this show is produced by me, Anna Milikian. Today, I'm replacing Catherine here, and I'm thrilled to be able to also be on the air. And you can visit the show page at blogtalkradio.com/ICF Phoenix, blogtalkradio.com/ICF Phoenix. And there you can find a lot more about the show and about the host, the producer, and, of course, of the ICF Phoenix chapter. If you are listening to this show live and you have a computer nearby, please visit our Facebook page at facebook.com/ICF Phoenix, facebook.com/ICF Phoenix. And because there is a post there about this show that we are going to use as our virtual chat room. You can post there your comments, your questions, your insight, because we love to hear from you. Even if you are listening to the recording of this show, please visit us at facebook.com/ICF Phoenix, or just search when you are in Facebook, ICF Phoenix, and like your page and leave your comments there. So, and today we have a very special guest, and we are going to be speaking one of my favorite topics. So it's Karen Kornblum, and we are going to speak about her career, coaching career, mindfulness, and coaching. And I'm going to read a little bit of her bio. Karen Kornblum is an International Coach Federation professional certified coach and a certified life coach with more than 1,000 hours of coaching experience. Karen works with individuals and teams and provides coaching and training for executives, emerging leaders, and fellow coaches which to tap into their potential. Karen is a lifelong learner, and she has many certifications and accreditations to prove it. She has a law degree from New England Law. She has a master in social work from the University of Alabama. She's also a licensed clinical social worker. And recently, Karen received a postgraduate certificate in neuroscience. I could spend the rest of the hour reading a resume. But you can find more about Karen at coachkaren.com. Coach is a regular spelling, C-O-A-C-H. Karen, you spell it as C-A-R-Y-N, C-A-R-Y-N.com. So coachkaren.com. And once again, if you go to blogtalkradio.com/ICF Phoenix, you will see this link in our website there. So welcome, Karen. Nice to have you here.
Anna, thank you so much for that beautiful introduction. I really appreciate it.
My pleasure. And when I was preparing for this show, reading your beautiful bio, and I have to cut things out because of the time, I was, oh my gosh, you have a so fascinating background. I would like to hear a little bit more. Where do you come from? How do you become a coach? I want to know more about you.
Okay. Thank you so much for asking. I was raised in Baltimore, Maryland, and I set out and got my undergraduate degree at Emory University in Atlanta, and got an accounting degree there, and was set to go into business, but I always had wanted to be a lawyer, so I went to New England Law in Boston And at Emory, I forgot to mention, I met a man from Alabama. And so I thought we were coming to Alabama just for a little while, but we wound up being here for 30. I've been in Alabama, Birmingham for 32 years. We moved here after we both finished law school. And I practiced law for, I did retirement plans, and I wanted to get into estate planning, which was very intimate and very, I really think it's a lot like coaching, and because it is intimate, and life happened for a bunch of reasons, one of which, a big reason, was that I had some difficulty having my children. I had to be on bed rest at some point, and then I had several other experiences, and I'm proud to say that I am the mother of three young man-childs, or men, young men. They are young men, 20, 25, and 27. And that really kind of got my, those kinds of experiences where I experienced some difficulty really clarified my values that being a parent, being a mom was very, very important to me. So I made some choices along the way, and I could have become, you know, I could have really gone out there and been very workaholic, because that was my past habit pattern tendencies. And I know that I still have them, but I'm more balanced, and I'm going to take a breath because I realize I've been talking for a long time without that.
Yeah, it's fascinating that, okay, like it's one of the things that I find amazing in the coaching profession, and I think it's one of the great characteristics of this profession, is that you arrive to become a coach after many other experience in your life. And you are saying here that you study, you got to become a lawyer, you are doing law, you are doing loads of things, you're having your life because everything happens. And my curiosity is, what was that experience? What was that moment that you decide, I want to become a coach?
Well, thank you, Anna. Yeah, so with what happened was I think I decided to go into accounting and law because it was a practical thing to do. It was like a mind override. And this was way back in the 1980s. And it was practical, and I think a lot of people did things because they were practical, and especially if you wanted to be successful. And I'm putting that in quotes. And it was kind of, it was not very mindful, you know. But in some sense it was. And then what happened was because of my experiences of having to, I was on bed rest and all of that, and my spouse worked as an attorney, which he was working 60 to 80 hours a week, I just knew that somebody had to be the grounding person at home. Mm-hmm. So I couldn't go out and work 60 hours a week because that's what it required, you know, in a law firm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And that was the culture of the of law firms, and I gravitated towards this nonprofit doing diversity training, and I just loved the work, and I wound up creating a program and actually leading a nonprofit doing diversity training, which was based on reevaluation counseling. And the concept of, have you ever heard of that?
No, no, but it's a very interesting, I love the reevaluation counseling.
Yes.
And I, another
yes.
thing, before you follow with that, because I think this is fascinating, but also how things happen in life, that you studied to be a lawyer. Your thing was to be a lawyer, and after law school, law and accounting, you saw, okay, I studied for that, like most people thinking, because we did these studies, we are going to be that. And that was the path that you have to make for yourself or society or make for you. And it's fascinating that life situations make you have to press the pause button. Okay, maybe you have to give up your dream. And suddenly you find even a better dream to follow.
Exactly, Anna. Only a coach would point that out. Thank you very much. And not only that, though, it is amazing, and because years later, my business background and my law background have helped me to become leadership coach and executive coach to people in business. I understand business, and that has served me so well. It just took a while to get there, you know, to tap in. And I'm so grateful that I have that background. I mean, I know the vocabulary. I know what a balance sheet is. I know what a financial statement is. I know what a budget is. I know business. So that has served me. Like we always find out in coaching, you know, we can make opportunities and take advantage of all the gifts that life has given us and we've chosen to take.
And that is another amazing thing that I see in mature coaches, that they start with a profession. In your case, you are an accountant in law. And then they find, by different accidents sometimes, or by different things, they found coaching, they fall in love with coaching, they get the training, and they go. And then it's like going full circle, but more like in a spiral, because it's really up-leveling things. They go back to their past experience and use them to go to another level.
Exactly. And so you'll really get a kick out of this, because the reevaluation counseling is a peer counseling model that is based on you take turns with your co-counselor, and one person listens affirmatively with loving attention while the other person talks and discharges. And that was my setup for coaching. That process, I learned that while I was doing my diversity training nonprofit, because the organization that I was working for used reevaluation counseling. And I used that process for myself to improve my thinking.
And when you are speaking about that reevaluation counseling and all that, and the process, for me, my background is in psychology, is coming Carl Rogers, and all the Rogerian system of empathy,
yes,
and listening, and all is there, and also many common things that coaching also took up. So wonderful, amazing.
Yes, exactly, exactly. And that had a major impact on me because I really invested in my own thinking. I didn't really have any sense of my own thinking before that. And so that was the experience, knowing what a shift coaching or reevaluation counseling, which is a foundational, you know, coaching method of listening,
mm-hmm,
to somebody with dignity and respect, believing that they're,
mm-hmm,
creative, resourceful, and whole, and
yeah,
believing in them, that shifted my being into, like, awakening my becoming a thinker and a learner. Yes, go ahead.
And from that awakening, from that experience, because you have done so many things, you became a social worker. Was that before or after becoming a coach?
It was when I was doing the diversity training, it was very emotionally based, and we would take large groups of people and teams in the workplace. So I was still in that workplace because of my background, and people would share stories of,
mm-hmm,
prejudice, racism, sexism, anti-Semitism, sexual orientation, and this was in the South. And people would get emotional. So it was like a group process, but we used that model, you know, which wasn't around psychopathology. But during that process, though, it was a goal for me that I wanted to go through some clinical training before I went,
mm-hmm,
into coaching, like, as, you know, just probably as a result of perfectionism on my part,
mm-hmm,
you know, just to broaden my, to know what coaching was and to know what coaching wasn't.
Mm-hmm.
And so I went and got my LCSW. I could, by the way, also fit it into my lifestyle, because I went, I could do it. It was just 2 days a week going out of town, and you know, I could drive back and forth the same day. It was an hour away to the school I went to, so it just fit. And I went to get my clinical social work degree with the intention of doing coaching first.
Wow. Okay, so
yeah,
that was like your preparation for, and at the time, because nowadays there are already coaching training within universities, but at that time I presume that there weren't none.
Nothing like that. Like, reevaluation counseling was the only thing available, and that wasn't really in academic books or anything, you know? Go ahead.
When you start your coaching training, which school did you went to get your coaching training?
The school that I went to was Falling Awake by Dave Ellis.
Yes. Yes.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And
institution. Mm-hmm.
Pardon me?
It's an amazing, they have amazing programs, the Falling Awake.
Yes, Falling Awake. And now he has transitioned to Dave Ellis leadership coaching, Dave Ellis leadership. And Anna, and also along the way, as I was becoming a clinical therapist, this is you'll like this link too, because this this is another thing. Because on the way to becoming a clinical therapist and a coach, I encountered this methodology using the body and the mind and the theory and the spirit called Pessoa-Boyden System Psychomotor, which was a very healing modality and uses the body and the and actually a lot of what I learned in that intensive training had to do with all the had to do with the brain and the body and the nervous system before this explosion of neuroscience. So
wow.
So I did this training and really at the time you could only practice this training if you had a therapy practice, and I didn't want to have a therapy practice. I wanted to have a coaching practice.
Yeah.
So I continued that kind of training with this post-grad certificate in the neuroscience of leadership, because it was continuing the neuroscience with everything I learned in this Pessoa-Boyden system of healing. And my goal really is to use that with my coaching clients who want to go deeper. Because now I have the language of the neuroscience and this other healing modality. So it's one thing of my offering. If people want to go deeper, I'm ready. And some of my long-term clients, we do that. We do just that. And I'm thinking of a way how to bring people in, maybe by saying somatic coaching or something like that. Because this kind of healing is very appropriate for coaching clients.
Very powerful. It's bringing everything together, holistic, very integrative. Wow. And where in all this, because I know you are a specialist, are a person that loves and a teacher or mindfulness. So where did mindfulness come in your path?
Yes, so mindfulness came in, again, along the way, because I've been a yoga practitioner for about 30 years, and that was now that I know a lot more about mindfulness, that was my mindfulness practice, and I had always heard in yoga about meditation, but the way I got into mindfulness was when I just finished this postgrad certificate of the neuroscience of leadership, we studied a lot about mindfulness. Because this postgrad certificate, which is run by the Neuro Leadership Institute and Middlesex University in the UK, is we studied decision-making and problem-solving, emotional regulation, collaboration with others, and facilitation of change. And a common thread of all of that is the research on mindfulness. Over and over and over again, the research on mindfulness says to have those skills, mindfulness keeps on coming up. So that's how I got. Yes.
So I have to ask you, because that mindfulness is a topic that nowadays everybody heard about it. It's a word that is in the top of the news. You see in the news, in publications. But what is your definition on mindfulness? Define mindfulness in a way that we can understand or we can people that are listening to this interview, we can get at what is mindfulness.
Yes. Yes, I can. And first, let's see, maybe we will, before I go into that, maybe can we do a quick exercise?
I like it. So instead of going straight to the brain, you are bringing us first to the body.
Yes.
Okay.
Brilliant, Anna. Just so, because I feel like there's been so much information. You know,
uh-huh.
I've been giving so much information that I want to get people, you know, connected with themselves and
mm-hmm.
connected in this experience so they can take in even more. That's my purpose of doing the exercise mm-hmm. right now. So are you game?
Love it. Yes, I am. Let's go for it.
Okay. So, and this is just a one and a half minute exercise.
Mm-hmm.
And I just want to invite people, if they want to first to sit comfortably or stand comfortably, feel your feet on the ground and your butt in the seat. And maybe listen, take a breath or two. And I'd invite you to close your eyes if that feels comfortable. If you don't, you don't have to. And I want you to just listen to these words, to be connected to the present moment. Breathe. Breathe again. Smile. Relax. Arrive where you are. Be natural. Open to effortlessness. Rather than doing. Drop everything. Let go. Arrive. And I'd invite you to open your eyes and just notice your experience. How was that, Anna? I'm going to have you talk. I hope people are listening, and I know you can write down your own experience as we're listening to Anna. So, Anna, how was that for you?
It's always, how they say, it's like, for me, it's like pressing the pause button, because, okay, I'm here, I have the screens in front of me with several windows open, I have my paper notes, and when you say, okay, just focus on your body, oh, I have a body, okay, yes, but you understand, it's like we are so trained to be neck up that just to the focus in our body, in ourselves, as a unit, is like, okay. And then noticing where I have tension in the shoulders, that's the typical area for me, and then allow that to relax when you are. And it's very important, I like the words, because
yes.
If it was no words at all, it's very easy. My monkey mind will start to go everywhere, but the words kept me centered and more
yes.
here.
Brilliant.
Oh, I enjoyed the experience.
Yes, yes. And that is, thank you. Thank you so much. I can certainly identify with you of just being a having the experience of acting like I'm a brain on a stick and not connected, not connected to my body. And I know for me, when I'm practicing and I'm starting to become more aware of my body, and that I'm not just a brain on the stick, that I'm a whole body human being, it is so grounding. It's much more grounding than when you're not aware that you have a body that breathes, that has a nervous system, all of that.
And I think it's a question that we have all of us are born with the body, but I think mainly in our Western society, everything is like all the training, all the conditioning is to keep us separate mind from body, to see this, we can go to Descartes and all the dualism, but is this, but if we look to even our experience, educations, and even the experience you spoke about, your experience of being a man, that you were bedridden for a while, and I was thinking about my own experience. Thank God my pregnancies were very okay. But afterwards, when the baby is born and we are so busy, so overwhelmed with things, we have to forget ourselves. We deny ourselves because of the other. And our pain, we have to overcome that. And the problem is not because there are circumstances in our lives that is the way, a good decision, in my opinion, to do. The problem is that we get in that modus operandi and we stay stuck there.
Absolutely, Anna. I totally, totally agree. And yes, and being mindful is such a resource, being connected to our body. It gives us information, a lot more, maybe even more reliable information than our thinking mind, than the prefrontal cortex, which can make up a story, you know, that can override who we really want to be and what we really want to do. Go ahead. What were you going to say?
And is that thing that I think mindfulness can be so helpful for us and for Western society in general, because give us a very practical and very a way that we can learn, that we can practice all these things. And I would like to ask you more questions about this, because this is a topic that we speak so much that we know so little. I speak by myself. So, because when we have in this experience here with you and other experience that a person that I like to follow is Daniel Siegel. Yes, amazing things in this area. But before I start to have the experience with mindfulness exercise, I have, like I think many people out there have this idea, okay, what is by the word mindfulness? So we don't have a mind. It's like almost mindfulness kind of thing. What is the aim of the mindfulness exercises? Can you speak a little about
this? Beautiful segue back on track to the topic at hand. Very mindful. So one way to describe at first, which it really does shed light on what the definition of mindfulness, because it's a big concept or experience to get, and it's so one way of describing it, and I do borrow from Daniel Siegel, who you mentioned, and Ellen Langer, who wrote a book on, I think it's called Mindfulness. Both of them describe mindfulness in as its opposite of, which is mindlessness. So what we mean by mindlessness is when we're operating on autopilot. So this can be An example of this is, like, I'm sure everybody has had this experience where you're driving a car and you mm-hmm. arrive somewhere and you don't know how you got there.
Yes.
And that is your unconscious driving the car. It is mm-hmm. not your attention. That's just your work, your long-term memory driving the car out of habit. And mm-hmm. and that's autopilot. And then another way we're mindless is is when we're being lost in fantasies mm-hmm. of the past or the future, where
daydreaming.
Pardon me?
Daydreaming, like a dream when we are daydreaming.
Yes, yes, and we're thinking about maybe our histories. Maybe we're thinking how somebody hurt us, and we're making up a story about how bad they are, and you know, we're thinking about that, or we're thinking, worrying about the future. This is mm-hmm. never going to end. Nothing's going to get better. That kind of futurizing in worrying, mm-hmm. not in the visualizing of coaching, where we're mm-hmm. visioning. It's more like the worry. The mindlessness. And if people after this call kind of start to pay attention, it's astounding. It's astounding mm-hmm. how much our brain is involved in either pasteurizing or futurizing. And then other ways of we know we're mindless is we're breaking or spilling things because we're not paying attention. How many times have we put something down and then we don't know where we put it?
In the multitasking situation that we have to do so many things at the same time and then we realize, oh, my gosh. And the scary thing is that we can spend one full day in autopilot until we crash in bed at night and say, oh, my gosh, what happened during the day? And it's like a blur.
Exactly. And if we let it, we can live our lives like that.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, rushing through things one after the other, you know, not allowing space for decompressing.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, I still unfortunately participate in those kinds of mindless activities. And mm-hmm. now, though, hopefully I'm aware. I become mm-hmm. aware that they are, which is on the way to mindfulness. So Killingsworth and Gilbert did a study where it's not just me and you, Anna. They did a study of 2,000 people, and they asked them, what were they doing? Where was their mind at the time? Were they happy when they were doing it? And 46.9% of the time, people were mindless. They were not connected to the present moment, and when they weren't connected to the present moment, they were not happy.
Mm-hmm. So we are in this state of autopilot of almost, it's a reactive state. We are reacting that something happened, and it's the autopilot that is doing things. I think everybody here listening to us speaking have that experience. But how does the mindfulness can help us to balance the mindlessness?
Right. So mindfulness, a definition of mindfulness is
mm-hmm.
three components: awareness mm-hmm. of the present mm-hmm. experience or present moment, with a special kind of attitude, with one of acceptance, openness, non-judgment, kindness, and compassion, or compassion. Those are words. So you're open to the experience. You're not judging it. You're not being critical of it. You're just being curious. Dan Siegel says, and this is something that helps with mindfulness, he says it's hard to be curious when you're furious. So if you're curious, you're open to the experience.
You spoke about three components. So the first one is that awareness of the present with these specific qualities. It's not any awareness, but awareness of the present with acceptance, openness, kindness, compassion, non-judgment. What are the other three? What are the other components?
Okay. Well, the first one is awareness.
Awareness.
So that's your attention. You're aware. So. The second is of the present experience. Yeah. And the third is with a particular attitude, with acceptance. With acceptance or openness or non-judgmental.
I like it.
Yeah.
Awareness, one component, present, the experience. And with a party, attitude. Okay, now I get it.
Right. So there's three components, and this was done. This was done by Kirk Brown, who is a researcher on mindfulness, on a study in 2007. Brown, Ryan, and Creswell, and it's actually there's a mindfulness awareness attention scale that he created. So it's something that we can measure. You know, we can improve on our ability to be aware of our experience in the present moment. And it's an innate ability of human beings. We come with this ability. It's just that we have to remember to practice it, to use it, remember to turn it on.
And tell me a little bit about, because with all your acknowledgement and study of neuroscience, what does neuroscience tell us about all this?
Oh, great. That's a great question. Okay. So it's a little... You know, I would say we're living in a really cool time because there's lots of scientific research being done on mindfulness that we're getting great results. I mean, there still needs to be more specific studies, but there's the fMRI machines, the functional magnetic resonance imaging machines, which show areas of the brain that are lighting up. With the advances in technology, we are beginning to see that science is confirming what spiritual practices have known for thousands of years. Right? So now the West can say, all right, our science, our methodology is proving this to be beneficial for human beings too, because we all know when we see people who practice mindfulness, they are calm, they have this kind of presence, you feel good being around them, and they feel safe and non-threatening and very loving. And that's where I want to get to be to make more mindfulness a trait of how I am, our being in coach language, the beingness part of being alive and having a life, we can extend having just states of mindfulness into becoming part of our personality.
Yeah.
And for me, that's really my goal.
I've heard about studies that even show that the Buddhist monks or some people that practice lots of meditation and mindfulness, their brain is different than many
exactly.
of us in the Western society. So
right.
the neuroscience is showing that.
Right, exactly, Anna. So let me try to... I'm going to get to that in a second. Let me try to explain it this way. Okay, so one way you can talk about the brain is by breaking it up into two different circuits.
Mm-hmm.
One called the narrative circuit.
Mm-hmm.
This is the story, the concept, the past and the future and the threat and the reward systems. So it's, you know, the outer layers of the PFC for the concept, the past and the future is your hippocampus, and the threat and the reward system is the limbic system.
Yeah.
And this is when we say as coaches, what story are you telling yourself, you know? And when our brains are at rest, our brains go to this narrative circuit. That's called the narrative circuit. Then there's another circuit that we have called the circuit of direct experience. And that's when we have data in the present through our senses. So this is when we're really looking at something with all of our awareness, like right now, if you have a window, that's really nice.
Mm-hmm.
Look out the window with your eyes. You know, your orbital cortex is lighting up because that's the part of the brain that your eyes see through.
Yeah.
And so it's your sensory information, what you're hearing. You're hearing my voice right now. If you're paying attention to my voice right now, you're hearing. If you're looking out a window or looking in the room at something and paying attention to what you're looking at, that's your direct experience.
And that mindfulness is about activating the circuit of the direct experience?
Not necessarily. All right, so I wanted to set that up. All right, so it's a little bit more complicated than that. This is really complicated because it's not conclusive yet, but listen to this, and then we'll go back. So we have those two kinds of circuits, right?
Yes.
So we have the narrative circuit and the direct experience circuit. So when the narrative circuit is on, the direct experience is off, and vice versa.
Mm-hmm.
When the direct experience circuit is activated, the narrative circuit is turned off. So they're anti-correlated with one another.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. So mindfulness, now hold on to your seats, mindfulness is when you're aware of which circuit you're on. Yeah, you're aware of which circuit is functioning, and you're able to switch.
Yeah, so I can be aware of my narrative circuit that I'm telling a story to myself, but I'm present there. I'm aware of it, of that present experience. The present experience is not external, it's my narrative internal in me, and I can accept that with a particular attitude, so there will be mindfulness.
Yes, that's right. So when you're in a story, when your narrative circuit is going, and you have the observer part of you noticing, noticing that you're in that story, and you're able to, with love and acceptance, bring that attention back into the moment, that's mindfulness.
Wow. That's
mindfulness. Yes.
That is very clear. And oh, my gosh, I'm looking to the time. We have more, 9 minutes left, and so many things that I want to ask you. I'm mindfulness of the time, and I don't know if I, and I'm sure that I'm using this not in the right definition of mindfulness. But let me ask you a couple of things, and let me, I know that I'm rushing you a little, but I really want to have a couple of things that I want to ask you. One that is coming out from our conversation here while you are speaking about and giving this great framework of looking and understanding to this is mindfulness a way of meditating? Because there is meditation is also something that is very in fashion nowadays. So is mindfulness a particular form of meditation, or meditation a particular form of mindfulness, or something else?
That's a great question. Meditation is a way to improve mindfulness, okay? It is a formal practice, and it's not the only way. It is a good way, though, to improve your innate ability to have mindfulness, and that would be a practice, you know, of meditating either on the breath, on a word, like a mantra meditation, or focusing on the breath and constant and gently bringing back your attention to that word or to the breath. That is one way of increasing mindfulness. You know, other ways. Or even just for a minute or two to be aware of what you're doing when you're doing, what you're doing when you're doing it. And like, let's do a quick, this is a 15-second exercise, okay? Let's, if everybody, and it just kind of highlights the direct experience. So just notice your feet on the floor for 15 seconds. I'm going to time you right now. Okay. So everybody listening, and Anna's going to speak just as a one person, but were you able to, did you notice, Anna, were you able to pay attention to the data that your feet were
before,
giving you?
Before you called attention to the feet, I wasn't aware of them. Then I became aware that one is fully on the in the foot and in the floor, that the one is one part is not supported, so I became more conscious of them, where they are and what they are doing, and where they are, the feeling of the, I'm with some slippers, the feeling of the shoe in my feet, and I added the instinct of the thing of moving the wiggle the finger the toes, just to be even more aware of them.
Right. Great. So, exactly. So, that's what we call like an informal practice of just strengthening mindfulness. Because, you know, doing what you're, being aware of what you're doing when you're doing it. So, making an intention and just having moments like that, taking a mindfulness moment, either if it's by breath or just you know, looking out your window, just being mindful, or gardening, mm-hmm. if you're doing your gardening, if you're walking, if you're running, what if you're exercising. People can practice mindfulness like that, or they can practice it formally through meditation. And I wanted to just say that, and I know we're running out of time, but I wanted to follow up with what you're saying. Like, there are actual, like you were saying, there's actual, like, thickening of cortical material in the brain of long-term meditators, their insula, which is the part of the brain that measures empathy, that's responsible for empathy, that grows with meditation practice, with a lot of meditation practice. Also, the ability to self-regulate, not so reactive. This is where it's really important for people, because people's relationships, that's what makes people have a good quality of life, is our relationships. And when we're more able to self-regulate, which mindfulness definitely gives us that ability, that grows our capacity, because more of the brain becomes a self-regulating system. There's people that when they meditate, more of their brain becomes the part that inhibits reactivity.
Yeah. So
does that make sense?
So make lots of sense, I think. And the image that is coming for me is that meditation, just to try to bring a little bit things together, meditation is like a way of exercising our muscles, like when we go to the gym and there is a specific routine that we follow to strengthen our muscles. And the other ways there, if we walk, if we go outside, is we are also strengthening our muscles, but in a not so formal way. And this also is this, because that is where the image of strengthening the muscles come, because then give us resistance, give us resilience for improving in other areas too.
Right, and there's increased perception. We can see more possibilities. Mm-hmm. We have more insight, more positive mood, increase in kindness towards ourselves and others, increase of immunity in other biological functions. I mean, that's where this mind-body thing is. You know, there's no arguing that the mind and the body are one thing. There's and also increase in, like I said, emotional regulation, and increase in when you're caring for others. You know, in less burnout when you're mindful.
Yeah, and it's also the self-compassion is also something that we exercise when we are being more mindful.
Yes, self-compassion is, I see it as it's the more we're self-compassionate, the more we're mindful, and the more we're mindful, the more we're self-compassionate. Yeah. And there's a whole thing on self-compassion, but you can be compassionate towards others without being self-compassionate towards yourself. And when we are more compassionate to ourselves, we can change more. And that's where I see such a link to coaching, because we're all about assisting people to change and using self-compassion as the root to change is what I'm really excited about. And it all stems from mindfulness.
Using self-compassion as the root to change. Love it.
Yes.
And what a great way, because we are really at the top of the hour, and what a great way of finish this, using self-compassion as the root of change. And of coaching. It's been a pleasure to have you and to have this conversation with you. I could keep going for another hour. So the listeners of this show, please go to blogtalkradio.com/ICF Phoenix. You will find our websites there. Engage in our facebook.com/ICF Phoenix. And let's keep this conversation going after the show. Thank you so much, everybody, for listening in. And thank you so much, Karen, for being in this show with us today.
Anna, thank you so much for having me. And if I can be of assistance for anybody, please contact me. I'd love to talk more about this.